Greetings to everyone. I'm glad you put the talks in this order. I definitely feel that Ben's and Elvira's talks have given me something to build on. So I am going to be talking about what human rights could contribute to a global agenda on health equity. I'm going to be talking about what some of the challenges and the controversies have been in defining and measuring health inequalities. That's the term that's used in most of the world. Here we say disparities. What's at stake? Why those controversies matter at all? And then I hope to make a case for how the human rights laws and treaties and principles, which I am subsequently just going to refer to as principles, unless I'm specifically referring to a law or a treaty, how the human rights principles help to address the challenges that those of us in the field of health equity and health inequalities have faced. So I wanted to start with this to make a point, and I thought Ben really, you know, pressed on this button, the issue of, you know, when we're talking about equity, we're not talking about averages. Averages are very important. You know, we do care about average health levels in a population. But when we're talking about health equity, health inequalities, health disparities, I'll get closer to it. Okay, thank you for telling me I wasn't being heard. What we're talking about when we're talking about health equity is not the average. By definition, we're talking about differences, and not just any old differences in health. We're talking about differences in health between groups who are faring better and groups who are faring worse. But if you look in the dictionary at inequalities or disparities, you're going to find that they're defined just as differences or variations. And if you look at the definitions of health disparities from virtually all of the major U.S. health agencies, and the one exception is a definition in Healthy People 2020, if you look at those definitions, they just define health disparities as health differences between different populations. That's essentially it. So that encompasses every kind of health difference that you can think of. It's the whole field of epidemiology, which studies the distribution of diseases and risk factors across different populations. But that's not what we mean. That's not what the people who first coined the phrases health disparities, health inequalities, that's not what they meant in launching the relevant movements. Margaret Whitehead, who's in the UK, I think has written the most eloquent definitions of health inequalities, health disparities, and health equity that have worked quite well in Europe, but perhaps not so well here. So Whitehead's definition of a health inequality, health disparity, is a health difference that's unfair, that's avoidable, and that's unjust. Here in the U.S., that hasn't worked so well because of a lack of consensus that differences, for example, by socioeconomic status or position, or health differences by race or ethnic group, that those are inherently unfair, and I'll talk more about that. So fairness, avoidability, and injustice can mean very different things to different people. You know, there are certain, there are several countries in which the powers that be would tell you that the exclusion of women from civil rights is fair because it just, it is in keeping with their traditional role in society and their needs. So it depends upon who's defining what's fair, and you need something more rigorous than that. So are all health differences unfair? I don't think so. I've made a list here of some differences. You know, our arm and leg fractures. If you hear that there are more arm and leg fractures among skiers than among non-skiers, I don't think you're going to be very moved, or you shouldn't be. Please don't be. But But there is one here, this one, the younger adults are generally healthier than the elderly. The older I get, the more unjust that seems to me. But I don't think I'm going to succeed in organizing a very effective movement around that one. Some will claim that if a health difference is avoidable, then that health difference is unfair. But who determines what's avoidable? You know, poverty will always be with us. And certainly many people who believe poverty will be with us and the poor will always be sick. And so that's not unavoidable. And here's another problem with the health disparities, health inequalities, or those health differences that are unfair or unjust. What if the causes aren't known? What if the causes of a given disparity? My own work that focuses a lot on maternal and infant health and my empiric work focuses a lot on birth outcomes, low birth weight, preterm birth. These are incredibly important predictors of health. They not only are the strongest predictors of who's going to survive to get to their first birthday, but of the development of chronic disease much later in adulthood and premature mortality. And for quite a while, we've had data showing us that newborns born to African-American women are 2 to 3 times as likely as their counterparts born to European-American women give birth to babies who have low birth weight and have or are born prematurely, but we don't know the causes. There are many of us who are working on this, doing research. Many of us suspect that they are due to causes that definitely would fall into the unfair arena that most people, in fact, would agree that, but we don't have the proof. And there are others, there's a big camp that's saying they're genetic, which I don't think is consistent with the evidence, but there still is a big camp, and we can't, you know, no side can win until we know more in research. But given the importance of these birth outcomes to health, if we said that, health disparities are those differences that are unfair or unjust, how could we say that they are unfair or unjust if we don't know the causes? How can you point your finger and say that's unfair? So people, I'm not saying that that has actually happened, but perhaps more challenging things than that have emerged in this. And so in looking at where the challenge, the potential challenges were, you know, this is one of the areas that I think is really important. And during the discussion, if people want to talk about the issue of, you know, health inequalities, health disparities versus health inequities, but it gets back to this some is being mindful of the fact that for a lot of the very important health disparities that we care about, we don't know the causes yet. Another area of challenge that's not met by any simple or eloquent definition is the issue of between which groups. We're making a comparison in these health differences, and we're comparing better off groups and worse off groups, but people with autism, certainly that's a worse off group, right? And then you compare them to people who don't have autism. And you could do that with almost any disease. And then the resources, the small resources that get directed to initiatives focusing on health disparities and health equity, do you want to see those resources go again to where the rest of the National Institutes of Health is directed, to these disease-specific initiatives? And without any regard for what the justice issues are behind the differences. Another challenge is that of whether we're talking about individuals or we're talking about social groups. And some people who were in prominent positions in WHO around 1999-2000 claimed that we should stop focusing on health inequalities and health equity the way we had been, where we're comparing, for example, the health of the rich with the health of the poor, the health of a dominant racial ethnic group like whites in the U.S. with the health of a racial ethnic group that has been historically disenfranchised, like African Americans and Latinos, we shouldn't be doing that. What we should do is just compare the health of the healthiest with the health of the sickest. And then later we can begin a process of inquiry about what the causes are. So if you think about it for a minute, you will realize that that takes social justice off the agenda then. And it means that in ministries of health, for many of the countries in the world, they depend on WHO for the technical support for their surveillance, their public health information functions. It means that with all the work that had gone on before that point, when these people came into power, then work to strengthen the capability of countries, and specifically developing countries, to monitor health equity within their own territories. If you redefine health inequalities and health equity in this way, you're not going to have that disaggregated data on it. You're not going to have your data on health disaggregated according to markers of social advantage and disadvantage, which is not an easy thing to do. And that was part of the appeal of the proposal that these people had. So, oh, it's hard to measure socioeconomic factors. It's hard to get the information on race or ethnic group, on disability, et cetera. So here's this nifty new idea. We'll just ignore all that. We'll ignore the markers of disadvantage and just look at the health of the healthiest versus the health of the sickest. Another challenge is about how, when we're talking about health equity, are we just talking about the risks to health that are posed by a lack of medical care, or do we pay attention to the social determinants of health? Is that part of the basic concepts? So what some of us contend is that this body of human rights laws, treaties, and official documents like General Comment 14, which is incredibly important, and principles in other official documents that have come out of the human rights monitoring bodies, or the human rights, international human rights bodies, that these really can help us address these challenges. Ben noted that there are civil and political rights. And that's what most people think of when they think of human rights, but then there are also the economic, social, and cultural rights, which include not only the right to health, which is the most famous of those, but the rights to education, the decent living standard, the benefits of progress, participation in society, the right to develop one's own potential. And that the right to health framed is the right to achieve the highest attainable standard of health. And said these rights are considered interconnected and indivisible, so that you can't, if you're someone who just want to focus on the civil and political rights, you cannot do that. And a claim can be made that the civil and political rights of someone are necessarily violated if their economic, social, and cultural rights are violated. That's really the implication of that concept of indivisibility. There's the concept of progressive realization, because everyone was very clear that most countries, in fact, would not have the resources to immediately protect protect and fulfill the rights of all of the people in their population, and particularly with this broad conception of human rights is embracing the rights to the social determinants of health. So the way the language goes is that that governments have an obligation to engage in progressive realization, to move toward realization of rights. And a very important aspect of this, that it is made implicitly clear that the obligation for progressive realization includes an obligation to give particular attention to removing the obstacles to rights that are experienced with those who face the most obstacles. The principle of non-discrimination and equality is also very, very important. and one of the most important aspects of this, I think, in thinking about health rights and health equity, is the notion that actions are prohibited that would have either the intent or the effect of discrimination, and that's very important. Much of what the disability community has had to fight for has not been so much against intentional discrimination, but conditions that effectively exclude them. In the United States right now, I think it's safe to say that in terms of racial discrimination, although intentional acts are still unfortunately frequent and they're there, but probably the most health damage is occurring because of a set of structures and processes that are the historic legacy of racial discrimination from when it was legal, starting with the slavery and then Jim Crow, and that the effects of those, that institutional racism, are felt in a very powerful way, even when no one intends to, when the intent to discriminate is no longer there. Another very important gift from human rights, I think, to the field of health equity is help in defining which are the groups we're going to prioritize, because, you know, better off, worse off, that's kind of vague. But in the human rights documents on non-discrimination and equality, they explicitly name a number of groups, which I've listed up here, including racial or ethnic groups, groups by socioeconomic resources or position, gender, of course, sexual orientation or gender identity. So you can see that list here. They do not explicitly say this, but I think that it is implicitly very clear from the language that what these groups have in common is that they are vulnerable groups because they have experienced a history of discrimination or marginalization, and they occupy a lower social position. So based on these concepts, definition of health inequality that colleagues and I have advanced, and which is now in Healthy People 2020, I'm happy to say, defined health inequality as a health difference that's closely linked with economic or social disadvantage, defining social disadvantage as in terms of wealth, influence, prestige, social inclusion, and that health inequalities adversely affect groups of people who have systematically experienced greater economic or social obstacles to health based on their racial or ethnic group, and then that long list of those categories that specify the relevant groups. So the rights-based definition, I think, makes it clear we're not talking about all health differences, and we're not even talking about all health differences that warrant attention. There are some very important health differences that aren't health disparities, health inequalities. So the health disparities and inequalities aren't the only important consideration. We have to consider aggregate population health. We have to consider efficiency and effectiveness. But all too often, the equity concerns have fallen from the agenda. So it's a particular subset when we're talking about disparities and inequalities that we need to be very upfront about saying it's a subset of health differences that raise concerns about social justice. And I think that there's been a lot of reluctance to do that. Certainly, when you look at the definitions from the federal agencies, they don't use the SJ word, social justice word. So that these are plausibly avoidable and systematic health differences that adversely affect a socially disadvantaged group. So it's not a difference on which one of those few, and there are some on which a socially disadvantaged group happens paradoxically to do better than the more advantaged group. There are differences on which the socially disadvantaged group does worse, and that disparity may reflect social disadvantage, but in any case, it is unjust because it puts already disadvantaged groups at further disadvantage with respect to their health. It's the kind of double whammy notion. So here's a already any socially disadvantaged group is at higher risk of worse health, and then you add to that worse health on a given health indicator, and that violates a fairly deeply rooted sense of fairness. I think even in this country of glorifying the individualism and not so much the sort of social fairness. So this definition and these concepts from human rights, I think, really address the challenges that I laid out for you at the beginning. One is the issue of the burden of proof regarding causation and avoidability. It is really hard to prove that this causes that. You don't want to have a definition of health disparities and health equity that require you to prove that something was caused by unfairness, even if you believe that you believe it was. But if you don't have the proof, you're going to lose that. So the definition can't hang on that. It hangs on the fact that the health inequalities are unfair because they put already disadvantaged groups at a further disadvantage on health. Or you could think about it in human rights concepts, further obstacles to achieving rights. In all cases here, we're talking about plausibility rather than needing proof. Talked about the groups versus individuals issue, the which groups, the defined measured how. I don't think I have time for that now, or to say more about some of the measurement challenges that I think that are addressed. There's still an ongoing controversy about what the reference group should be for disparities comparisons, and some say it should be the average, and many of us say no, that's not really in keeping with what the concept is. You're comparing the worse off to the better off, and referring to the language in the right to health as the right to achieve the highest attainable standard of health. And that what we've claimed is that the highest attainable standard of health, that's been criticized for not being, for being too vague and not being possible to operationalize. But I think you can operationalize it. And you can say that the level of health enjoyed by the most economically and socially privileged groups in your society represents at least what should be attainable by all. It's actually a lower standard because you should probably be doing it on a global basis. So that's a gift from the field of health equity to the field of human rights. The challenge about whether social determinants of health are on the table or it's just about medical care, I think that that's a very important contribution also of human rights. And that brings me to my final slide, and I want to go back to some really interesting points. Well, you both made very, very interesting points, and points that you made, Ben, about how at times there's this feeling that people don't want to acknowledge human rights because they see it as legal, and they're going to enter into, they're going to have legal obligations. The fact that human rights do have some legal force and the enforceability there is obviously very, very important, and it would be very foolish to back off on that. But the reality is that we know that we are not going to get the whole world to sign on, and in fact the U.S. has signed but not ratified. If you ratify, then you're obligated to report and you could be found in violation. Signing indicating that you basically endorse the basic principles and the values represented there. There are countries who are not going to ratify in that sense. And also we all know that even for the countries that have ratified human rights treaties, that in some ways that human rights are probably more often honored in the breach than in the observance, that the violations are going on all over the place. So why do I still think that human rights provides this very firm conceptual basis for the concept and the measurement of health disparities, health inequalities, and health equity? It's because the these agreements, the agreements that have been talked about, have been hammered out with global participation over a period of many, 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 many years. And they do represent, you know, for whatever the resistance is to ratifying and being subject to the enforcement, I think it is very safe to say this represents a global consensus on values and aspirations. And when I got interested in this issue of the definition of health disparities in a very practical situation where I saw that initiatives focused on social justice in health were going to be leaped over for technical efforts, and this effort was being made to redefine health inequalities in a technical way and removing the social justice content. But as I tried to mount a response to those who were proposing this, I found it was very, very difficult. And the field of ethics definitely contributes some to this, but not with the kind of specificity and richness and texture that the human rights laws and treaties and principles do. And so I think, I mean, we need to look at the whole body, you know, not just the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and on its own, and not just each of the covenants, the civil and political rights and economic, social, and cultural rights covenant, but also the general comments that do have, they're recognized as being official, that we look at the whole body of work that's been developed there, and we can say this represents a global consensus on values and concepts. And in trying to argue for why what this technical attempt to redefine health equity, for what was wrong with it, I found the human rights principles absolutely indispensable, and that there was a need for something that would have that force and that credibility. So I think that we have that with human rights, and let's open it up to some questions and answers.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our panelists here. We're going to open it up to questions in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to distribute the cards from our International Human Rights Committee to make sure that everybody has both our web address, which is located on the back, as well as the APHA set of principles related to health and human rights. So I'm going to pass these around now. We've had three really excellent presentations, I think, that cover the gamut. You know, Ben laid a really nice framework for the kind of foundations for health and human rights and what some of those documents are, as well as getting us thinking about the post-2015 agenda, the potential as well as the possibility for dangers and missed opportunities in the post-MDG era, as well as the somewhat contentious nature of human rights. Those of you in this room, many of us may think that human rights is a no-brainer for public health, but that is certainly not the case in some areas. And then also, I think this final presentation, getting us really thinking about some of the possibilities and the ways in which human rights may be a resource and a useful tool for us in our toolbox, especially as we think about the kind of joint preoccupation that both human rights and public health have for vulnerable populations. So let's open it up in our remaining time for questions for any of the speakers. Yes, please.
I really thank all of the speakers. You know, it was fabulous. But as I'm looking around the room, I'm only seeing one man. And in our world, where basically the world is dominated by men, like, I don't want to make it a men female, but I'm just wondering how successful can we be with human rights, and moving forward, where I'm also seeing that, you know, companies are keeping governments hostage. And again, governments are mostly run by men. I don't know, I'm feeling like we're doing this big runaround and we're not getting anywhere. And I sometimes get very I guess, very disillusioned by where we are going, you know, where, what we can do really. I mean, I feel, you know, oftentimes disarmed. And what hope is there? Because we see, we all know that there are so many disparities. But oftentimes I feel powerless just because the world dictates that to me.
That's why I think it's important to be part of APHA and part of the International Human Rights Committee, because it's something that nobody can do alone. And this is the time where we happen to be living. If we had been born maybe 100 years ago, it would have been a lot worse. But of course, if it were 100 years from now, we probably would have achieved so much more and we'd be facing other challenges. But I think that this is the time where we have chosen to live, and we have to live to the fullest, and we don't have to be alone. So when you feel down, just give us a call or Skype us. Well, it's a difficult field, and sometimes you're going to deal with people and say, how can they say that? And I mean, you'll have to enter your world and understand your world. So then you can find why they understand things that way, that think so much backwards and that doesn't make any sense to us. And really, when you enter their world and you're able to speak the same language, and then you're able to bring them to the light.
Well, a quick comment that my model is that the drops of water on the granite boulder.
And I like the positive story that's being told. I think I began with a story by saying that human rights are effective and influence the behavior of nations by talking about racial discrimination and slavery. I could have just as easily used women's suffrage. And that over the course of 100 years, a variety of different international legal prescriptions on discrimination, but also affirmative rights that need to be fulfilled for women. And we see this really come together in 1979 in the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. That this international legal document sought to combine these negative rights that we think of in the United States, do not discriminate, with some of the positive protections that are necessary in order to advance women's rights. And so I think to the extent that we look to this as a women's rights and women's empowerment issue, I think human rights tells, in some ways, a very positive story.
Yeah, and I think, just to kind of pull all of those pieces together, you know, Ben said human rights folks are never satisfied, and I think public health folks are never satisfied as well. So when you work combining health and human rights, you really have to be an optimist. But also, I think the thing that we have behind us is, bear in mind that 100 years ago, human rights, as we think of them today, didn't exist, right? I mean, there is history there. It's not to say that concepts of human rights didn't exist, but we didn't have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We didn't have an international covenant talking about the right to health. We didn't have General Comment 14 even 15 years ago. So I think that while there is a lot of work to be done, we also actually have made a lot of progress in kind of getting the global community to come together around concepts of rights, get those concepts kind of played out and put down on paper. And now the challenge for us is, how do we take it from paper to actionable items? And I think that's really our challenge.
And APHA can help.
Yeah. I saw another hand in the back, and then we've got two other hands. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. I had two questions for the panel, but I'm going to not ask those questions because I'd like to address what you said.
Okay.
I think the absence of men is a serious problem. I've been working in Afghanistan for the past 9 years, and one of the things that we encounter every day was absence of men. It took 3 years of advocacy with the ministry and some UN agencies to bring men on board on women's health and the graphic health, and maternal mortality and all that. I find he made a documentary film on it. It's called Where Are the Men? And it is a serious issue because some of the things that just came up here, it's all related because we're talking about women's rights, talk about human rights, and it goes to the question that maybe I will bring it up because it's really important. Everything that we're talking about here in some societies makes no sense. And when we go into these communities and we discuss human rights or women's rights and approach it on a Western model, it really not only doesn't work, but it backfires. So this particular program I'm talking about, which was taken over by the ministry 10 months ago, if you look up the website, Where Are the Men? The ministry took it over because there was such need and such support from the women's side, and the men actually stepped up. Afghan men did participate. They did work on women's reproductive health and reduction of maternal mortality. So I think that's really related to this human rights movement. We do not actively engage men. We do not actively go after men in cooperation, in the ministries, in UN agencies, and demand and ask and bring them on board. So I think there are two separate issues here, I know, but I just feel very strongly about which, because I've been dealing with it for years. But the good news is, it does work. It works in Afghanistan. I think you pretty much say it will work anywhere.
I totally agree with you, but I just have to say, you know, if the men don't show up, it's a leadership opportunity for the women. In my opinion, I'm not saying that men don't play an important role, but you know, we don't have to defer to the guys either. We can step up. So I think there's two sides to that equation, at least. We had two other questions in the front, and then yes.
Hi, I'm Simona Zilke from UC Berkeley, and I wanted to ask for the after 2015. How to increase the visibility of academia, because it's all about, you know, the UN family talking. And so here we have a panel of, you know, academic, and how do we make your voice more heard and, you know, better heard out there?
I would say that I'm an academic and I'm not trying to make my voice heard. I'm just trying to watch people who are doing that and try to analyze it in a productive way so that we can better understand how the UN is doing this. And I think to a certain extent, one of the advantages of the post-war world is that we've created a United Nations that brings together the world in shared global governance. And so,
for better or worse,
and my goal is not to challenge that, but to understand it, so that we can understand how to better allow nations to come together to create these universal norms. And yes, they need to be country-specific and even community-specific, but to create universal norms for justice that can encompass the entire world. And the post-2015 agenda is part of that effort. And I think to the extent that the nations of the world are coming together under the United Nations to create a shared moral framework for moving forward in the post-2015 world, to the extent that there isn't a moral foundation in human rights, then we'll face the same problems that we face with the Millennium Development Goals, where countries don't meet their goals and nobody cares. And so human rights provides a policy-relevant discourse by which we can show that we care.
I'd like to answer that. People at WHO read the literature, not just at WHO, UN agencies, academics can have a big influence, actually. And it gives me an opportunity to clarify something that I realized might not have been clear before. I spoke about the period around 1999-2000 when some people were in leadership at WHO and they tried to redefine health equity, health equality in a technical way. They were gone by 2004-2005, and this has not been a problem since then, as soon as they were gone.